Today's episode of the Film Stage Show is brought to you by MUBI, the online streaming cinema for your free 30-day trial. Go to MUBI.com/filmstage. History repeats itself. Try and you succeed. Never doubt that you're the one. Back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast for filmstage.com. I'm your host today to talk about the only film that made all of our top 10 lists, Princess Sid. We have Bill Graham.
Woo!
We also have Michael Snydell.
Hello!
How is everyone doing today?
It is snowing for some reason in February. I hate this stupid city.
It was snowing here for like 15 minutes, and then it just turned into a hard sleet. So that sucks. It sucks for the state of Maryland and the Washington, D.C. area. Before we get into all of our usual stuff, I just want to say we are recording this on Super Bowl Sunday, so allow us a brief digression. Welcome to the football crew. I'm Brian Rowan, your host, and we have with us on the sidelines Michael Snydell.
Hello?
We also have Howlin' Bill Graham.
Howl!
Yeah, we're here today talking about the Philadelphia Eagles versus the New England Patriots. Bill Graham, who do you think's going to take us all the way?
You can't vote against Brady.
Can't vote against Brady. Michael Snydell, what do you think?
I'm just a water boy.
This is what happens when you cut back on productions. I'm going to say the Eagles are apparently Michael Snydell, best commercial of the entire.
It's going to be Australia.
Nice. That's right. The whole continent of Australia, which is the only continent that's also a country. Final thoughts. Bill Graham, what do you think the final score of the game is going to be?
27-21 Patriots roll.
Low scoring game. You think that's going to be front loaded, or are we going to be looking at a nail biter?
Ooh, I think there's going to be a couple of kicks at the end that secure that victory.
All right, Waterboy, Michael Snydell, what about you?
I think a lot of people are going to lose money.
I think we're looking at a basketball score for this game. I think it's going to be 127-118 Eagles.
I'm not sure that's possible, but we'll go with it.
Hey, man, I'm all about making those big calls. Anyway, that's the end of our football minute. Hope you enjoyed it. It will never happen again. If you'd like... I don't know shit about shit. So the fact that you brought up a player's name threw me for a second.
I haven't watched a football game, you know, not hammered in a day.
I tend to enjoy watching football games, but I never do it because I don't have the time or the patience. So like when I can go to one in person, love it. When I was in college and I could go to the college games, enjoyed it. Like, oh, nice. I like, yeah, the strategy and the kind of like thrill a minute joyride that is a football game. But like watching it on TV is so hard. It's so hard for me to do.
Well, you picked the wrong day to just like have an easy go watching a football game that, you know, that's just going to be super short today, obviously.
Oh, yeah. I was looking it up yesterday because my friends were like, we should all do something, because we always end up doing something at the last minute. And I just like, I think I can stream it. Let me see when it starts. And it said 6 o'clock. And I was like, that seems a little early. But that's just the pregame coverage. I still,
yes,
don't,
sir,
think I have any idea when the game itself starts.
Nobody does. It just starts.
Yeah, it's just one of those things. It just kind of happens.
So do you think Justin Timberlake is terrible enough to actually bring Prince back as a hologram?
I think Justin Timberlake is terrible enough to do a lot of things. And it's very possible that he thought that was a good idea. Because I think he's going for the Prince Michael Jackson of the 21st century thing.
Well, him and Bruno Mars. Him and Bruno Mars are very much competing for that crown. But, you know, it's interesting because apparently, like, Prince is from Minnesota or from that area. And so that kind of makes a little bit of sense. But also, like, kill it with the hologram shit. Like, no.
I was about to say, also, like, he died very recently. And I just don't think that it's a good idea. Like, Tupac, he'd been gone long enough that people were like, oh, that's a novel thing. It was also the first time.
Still gross.
Is he gone?
Tupac?
I thought that was his first public appearance in a while.
Oh, Bill. I mean, I know that I'm all about the flat earth, but you really got to get off the Tupac Lives train.
Have we seen a body?
I don't know. I mean, Bill, have you yourself seen the earth from space? Can you say that it's a sphere?
No.
I've been on a high mountain peak, so does that count?
So have I, but look, just because the human eye can only see so far doesn't mean that we live on a sphere. I mean, have you ever tried to put something on a sphere and then see if it would fall off? Because it does. Now, you put something on a plate, though. We eat on plates. You know that stuff is on plates. Anyway, we're 6 minutes into this podcast.
That sounds about right.
I just want to say to anyone out there who's confused or who's listening for the first time, maybe, I don't actually believe in the flat earth. I just find it fun to learn about it.
That's dangerously close to believing in it, though.
I almost want to believe it seems like such a weird way to live.
Isn't that exactly what, like, Yoda and everybody says about, like, the dark side is don't learn about the dark side because then you'll become the dark side. So, Brian, but like, I just want to keep you tethered to something where we keep, like, trying to pull you back, because the further you go in, the more likely it is that your tether is just going to snap at some point
and you'll fall right into the abyss.
Yeah, well, as Nietzsche said, you know, he who wrestles with monsters should take care that he himself does not become one. Yes. But at the same time, you can't go trying to slay a dragon if you don't know where its weak spot is. So I like to learn about all the crazy things in the world so that if I ever have to argue against them, I know what I'm talking about. That being said, I am probably like one bad day away from just becoming a full-blown conspiracy theorist.
You're rubbing shoulders with some interesting company.
Look, Dwight D. Eisenhower signed a treaty with the Greys that allows them to take a certain percentage of our population to perform experiments on.
Oh, boy.
Okay.
X-Files is my favorite show as a child. So this is a movie podcast.
Woo! Okay. Are you ready for some football?
Oh, God. What was I going to say? Twitter.com/filmstageshow.
Jesus, what did y'all just say? Y'all were talking over each other.
I'm trying to get through all the stuff that we usually do, first of all. Twitter.com/TheFilmStageShow, podcast@TheFilmStage.com for email. Find us on Facebook, The Film Stage Show. Find us to give us a rating and comment on iTunes. Someone gave us a rating on iTunes, and they were just like, uneven, but still pretty good. And I feel like that's probably the most true that we've ever gotten. And I think they gave us 3 stars, though. But I think that probably deserved 5 stars. So go out there, give us a 5-star rating, and tell us what you really think about us. Don't forget to give it to our Patreon, patreon.com/TheFilmStageShow. For as little as $1 an episode, you get access to our Slack channel, super cool raffles, and of course you help us create even more shows for you to listen to. We were supposed to record our classic review on Paris, Texas last week, but my computer is a tubercular old man in a Western, and we don't know how long it's going to be around for, so it died briefly. It's back now, obviously. We're going to try to record that next week.
It's been resurrected.
Yep. Call this baby Lazarus, because it just keeps dying and Jesus keeps bringing it back.
I like to think it's on fire as you're recording right now.
it's like one of those,
I think we just lost Brian.
I'm just imagining, like, it's one of those, like, spaceships from, like, a 1950s movie where, like, the keys keep flying off and I just keep having to hold on to it and, like, slapping the buttons back together. Yeah, pretty much. It's It's not great. I can hear the hard drive spinning inside of it sometimes in a way that sounds very bad for it. But what are you going to do?
Yeah, you're fucked. You're fucked.
The last podcast will be the sound of a minor explosion and me being murdered by my laptop.
I think we found the low-level hum that we were wondering about the last podcast. I think it might just be your computer, Brian.
That would be hilarious if my computer was so bad that it was interfering with the podcast. But no, it's not. My microphone is calibrated perfectly. So anyway, let's also remind the fine people at home that you can get a free 30-day trial of Mubi by going to mubi.com/filmstage. Mubi, of course, the best film streaming service on the internet. You get a new movie each day. You have 30 days to watch, so you have a constantly rotating stream of 30 movies that you can download to your device, watch on your smart TV or your laptop or your PC, watch them on the go without having to use up all that precious, precious data. And they've got some great stuff out. In fact, they've released a movie into theaters, Lover for a Day, and you can go to loverforaday.mubi.com to see if that is playing by you. Again, for your free 30-day trial, go to mubi.com/filmstage. And we are here today to talk about Princess Cid because there wasn't really anything else to talk about. And we all kind of surprised one another by having it be the only film that made all of our top 10 lists when we did our top 10 episode. And we had had the director on previously to talk about the Meyerowitz stories,
yeah.
New and selected. I keep wanting to call it the Meyerowitz Chronicles, as though it were some sort of YA film, but it is not. But we only had a brief opportunity to talk about it then, so we figured, why not, on this beautiful, sleeting, snowing, disgusting Super Bowl Sunday, talk about Princess Cid before we get the latest glut of new films to talk about. Though apparently Jumanji... We may be doing Jumanji. It started as a joke, but as that film continues to roll through cinemas, taking the top spot again this weekend, we might not be able to hold off The Rock any longer.
I think it was fun to give a little inside baseball. Someone brought it. I think you brought it up as a joke, and then Bill was like, oh, wait, no, I'm really into that. And I'm like, wait, I like The Rock. Let's see it. So
No. I wasn't just I'm into that. I was just like, no, I just came back from it. It was good.
It's one
I
of those,
enjoyed it.
Like, I don't think that I would disenjoy it, because like I said, I love The Rock. Kevin Hart's funny.
Okay.
I definitely have an interesting story. I have a fun story of a theater experience during this movie, so it'll be
we're
fun
gonna have to do
about
a podcast on it so that you can tell that story.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, because right now we are going to talk about Princess Cid. This is from writer-director Stephen Cohn, and it stars Rebecca Spence and Jesse Pinnock. And here is the trailer.
Oh my god. You grew up.
Hey. Your dad told me that you're thinking about coming up here for college. That's exciting.
Yeah, maybe.
You new to town? I'm visiting my aunt.
I'm Katie.
Cid.
Hey, I get off in about 10 minutes if you want to, I don't know, go for a walk or something.
Okay.
Your aunt cool?
Yes.
All right. That is the trailer for Princess Cid. It's got terrible music in the background. So let's talk about this great movie that made all of our top 10 lists. First of all, the synopsis, coming off of IMDb, eager to escape life with her depressive single father, 16-year-old athlete Cid Laughlin visits her novelist aunt in Chicago over the summer. While there, she falls for a girl in the neighborhood. And various other things happen from there. I decided to cut off the end of the synopsis. So, what was it about this movie that made it the only film that actually hit all of our top 10 lists? Let's talk about it. I kind of want to do this a little differently. I just feel like we've talked about it once, and then we talked about it on the top 10 episodes. So we don't really have to go into our general all-around thoughts. It's fairly clear that we all thought it was a very good movie. So I just kind of want to talk about the things about it specifically that like hit each of us in a way that we felt that it was worth lauding amongst the many, many films that we saw last year. So Michael Snydell, why don't you kick us off, since you were the one who saw it again, the most recently. What is it about Princess Cid that you think kind of elevated it into the position that it was this year for us?
For us or for me?
For you, I think, and those for are us two in general. Like, do you have a kind of like a vision as to, because we're three pretty disparate gentlemen. So for you personally, and like, you know, I guess that would tie into the general group dynamic.
Well, I think, you know, I was actually trying to figure out this exact question of why it did kind of appeal to all of us. And I think it's kind of because it is a film that's all about an exchange of ideas. And I think that inherent like openness and that ability to have these wide-ranging, feels weird to call them opinions, because opinions almost sounds like too antagonistic for what this movie is, because it is everyone. It's just kind of weird because this is very much set up as like almost an odd couple movie in a way that I didn't recognize the first time, in the sense that she's an author, and Rebecca Spence's Miranda is an author. Her niece is Cid, is a soccer player. Like, those are the initial things we know about these two characters. And I think even from the beginning, I think it's really interesting that they seem to be talking right past each other. Their first interaction is literally about them, specifically Cid, kind of continually interrupting Miranda as she's talking about her novel and what she does. And it's kind of weird that they're almost like giving an elevator speech to each other in a sense, because they haven't seen each other. They say in the film that Miranda hasn't seen Cid since she was, you know, 6 or 7, and she's now 16 or 17. I believe that's right. I'm not sure we ever get an exact age for her. But yeah, I think that it is just, this is the type of open-hearted, like, conversational movie we just don't get that often. And I think the one thing that really elevates it for me is it's at once very much explicit and clear about what it's about without actually, like, hitting you over the head with it. I kind of think that they say the thesis of this movie at least 3 or 4 times in the movie, and that should be terrible. That should be a reason in itself to, you know, almost like dismiss this movie. But I think there is something, there's just an honesty here that I think appealed to all of us, even before you get into specific things like religion or sexuality or just trying to understand family who you didn't know, and trying to understand the past when it's kind of an unknown. And I just think the combination of those very specific topics, which I know, at least Brian, as far as you, I know religion strongly appeals to you. You especially like films that have to do with circumstances of faith, not only as a religious person, but in general. I know that's something you're interested in. I think Bill as well is very interested in the way that two people from different backgrounds and just people who are fun to listen to. Like, I think there's just something very entertaining and melodious about this whole movie before you even like dig under the surface. And now I'm certainly rambling, but yeah, that's my guess about why it maybe appealed to all of us.
I love that as time has gone on, you've come to like understand that you have a tendency to ramble, and your response to that has just been to call yourself out before anyone else can.
Well, you gave me two gigantic
questions. Oh, I know. I know. I understand. No one has ever... This is the thing. No one ever calls you out on rambling, because we all do it. But you have just become obsessed with, like, singling it out and then calling yourself out and then just wrapping up.
I feel like I fell asleep, like, on a canoe and I'm in the middle of a lake right now and I don't have an oar or anything. So I'm just kind of...
Because we're so quiet. Yeah, because we're so quiet, you're still not quite sure if the podcast is still going or if the earth has already just ended.
Exactly.
That flat earth. All right, Bill Graham. Same question.
Spinning like a pizza.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, God. I'm just thinking about how someone in like one of my flat earth videos would like take the pizza analogy to the utmost extreme. Anyway, Bill Graham. So what is it about Princess Cid that innately appealed to you? And do you have like a read on like, do you agree with Michael as to like the reasons that it kind of appealed to all of us?
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what he said there. He said a lot, so I don't agree with everything.
Point by point, please go through everything that Michael said.
Oh, Jesus, no. I will say that it is interesting because this film does directly speak to a lot of our desires from even like coming of age films. Brian, you have very specific like things that you do and do not want to see and coming of age. Avoids a lot of those traps because instead of it coming of age with a parent, it's coming of age with kind of a relative, a somewhat well-known relative, but someone that doesn't quite know. So they're always kind of catching up and they're always trying to figure each other out. And it's one of those interesting dynamics where they can speak honestly to each other at points in this movie where I feel like so many other movies just don't have that, because I feel like so many parents in films and even in reality just struggle to figure out how to talk to them as another human being instead of their son or daughter. And this film doesn't make bones about that, because she I don't even know if she's necessarily the main character, the co-star, I guess, Rebecca Spence. Her character often has tough conversations with students or people that she's editing and things like that. And so that's her reality. And so when Cid comes into her life, that's more of that, where she just treats her kind of like, you know, like she's editing her paper and her paper just happens to be her life. And so, you know, they have serious discussions about things. And I think that's a brilliant way to kind of get around a lot of the awkwardness of, you know, parents talking to their children, because even, you know, and I've seen this dynamic when I speak to certain people in, you know, kind of outside life and things like that, whether I'm coaching them or whatever, is if a parent says something to a child, they have a tendency to, until they turn, you know, 18 or 19, they have a tendency to just be like, yeah, yeah, yeah. But if I go up and say something to them, they actually listen and they actually, you know, engage with me at a level that I feel like they often don't with their parents. And so this movie kind of reflects that reality in my view in a lot of ways. I think the performances are great. I think the film focuses in on development through their interactions versus just their development through pushing the plot forward. As far as the plot, there's not a whole lot of, you know, point A, point B, point C in this film, but it still moves at an interesting enough clip. And it's under 2 hours, I'm pretty sure. So
an hour and 36 minutes.
Yeah, it went there. So yeah.
A plus runtime.
5 stars.
Yeah, so for me, I think it's funny because I didn't like two approved critical darlings this year, one of which was Lady Bird and the other which was Call Me By Your Name. And I feel like, I honestly feel like seeing Princess Cid screwed over both those movies hard because like this is such a like a brilliant, affectless, like honest movie that does what both of those movies do a lot better than they do. And as Michael said, without kind of like the ostentatious, like bludgeon you over the head. And as Bill said, I didn't even really think of this movie as a coming of age movie until Bill said it.
Yeah.
Just because I think that it pairs up with what Michael said, that it's not bludgeoning you over the head with that. You know, this isn't a movie where people keep saying, when you grow up, you'll understand. Or like, if you knew everything your mother and I had to go through, or. And I think the fact that it doesn't take place during the school year helps a lot, just in that way. Movies that kind of follow people through a school year have a tendency to rely upon that as kind of like a, I don't want to say a crutch, but as like an ingrained framing device and a pacing mechanism. And I think that when I look back on my youth, my misspent youth, lo, those many years ago, I don't think of it in that way. I think of like the assemblage of things that happened, and each of those things feels very distinct without thinking about, oh, my sophomore year of high school, the year that I, and now I'm freezing up because I don't think about it like that. So I can't really define what happened to me sophomore year versus what happened. Well, I guess senior year I was in Texas. So there's a very big divide there. But otherwise, like I can't sort things out like that. So the honesty of this movie in that way and the understated nature of it really helps me because that's just who I am and what I like in a film. Another reason that I find myself drawn to this movie is how much agency it allows each character while still keeping mind of like the authority involved. The power dynamic between them, one of them being an adult, the other being a teenager, but allowing them both to have feelings and emotions that they are right to express because that's who they are. And the way that that balance tips from friendly to occasionally the aunt asserting her authority. I think that's a very true to life way to look at things because when you're a teenager, you have a tendency, if someone treats you as an equal for long enough, you sort of assume that you can just keep rolling with that. And every once in a while, someone's got to slap you down and remind you of who you are. And I think that in this movie, they show that in like a very true and respectful way. And the way that you'd kind of hope that every adult would speak to a teenager or a child. And I like that. But the thing I think that appealed to me most about this film, and the reason that it ended up kicking Blade Runner 2049 off of my top 10, is we're kind of coming up in a world where you don't really hang out or talk or reason with people who have different ideas than you. And we've become a lot less accepting of people whose values or whose sense of self conflicts with our own. And this is a movie that kind of, I don't want to say, it's not acting like an olive branch and these two characters don't ever like go to war in that way. But it's interesting to see a movie where two people who very clearly have different thoughts and opinions are still able to coexist and respect one another. Sid kind of openly says that she doesn't read books and her aunt,
yes,
you know, is like, what? Okay, well, that's weird. But it's, she never then thinks like, well, this kid's a fucking idiot. Like, she's not looking down on her for that. And Sid, you know, never thinks, well, my aunt's lame as hell because she's just got her nose in books. Like, they both kind of, through their shared interaction, get one another to approach situations that are different than what they might expect, but in their own way, they never appear to really become uncomfortable with each other. And like you said, Michael, I love a story that is about religion in usually a very specific way. I love any story that gives someone a value system or an ethical or moral code and then just tests the hell out of it. that's the kind of conflict that I sort of love. And that can manifest itself either in religion or like a gunslinger in the Old West who's promised he's never going to shoot anyone again, or even someone who has like a crippling depression. Like, just trying to test the boundaries of that and seeing how someone reacts, I think, is one of the most compelling stories that you can tell. And this is a movie that's almost explicitly about that, while also understanding that you can feel differently than someone else and yet still have respect for that person. And every, like, probably like once a week while viewing the discourse online over different people telling each other how they should think and act, I think of the scene in the kitchen that Sid and her aunt have, and how the aunt says, like, I find different joy in life, and that's okay. It's not up to you to tell me that my joy is wrong, just as it's not up to me to tell you that yours is. And it's just, it's such a simple idea that we just have like no concept of. It's funny that we're doing this on Super Bowl Sunday, and I'll just wrap up with this thought, Bill. It's funny that we're doing this on Super Bowl Sunday because I don't even want to go online, because people are going to be like, oh, I hope the sports ball team beats the other sports ball team. Or they're going to say something like, you're wearing the like clothes of someone who's never going to know your name. Like, why would you do that? Or talking about like, well, sure, like someone got a touchdown and that's great, but did you cheer that loudly when like the Supreme Court allowed gay marriage? And it's like, you know, just fucking let them have it. Like, it's not hurting you. It's not hurting them. Yeah. They're getting like a small fraction of joy in a world that's rapidly going to shit. It's not doing an active harm to anyone. And why is that wrong? Like, why are you trying to bully and punish someone into caring about the things that you care about?
Yeah. I think, Brian, you mentioned that scene in the kitchen. And I think that's really the scene where I started to kind of perk up and started to really follow intently on this film. And it's because at one point, Sid says something to her aunt, and her aunt kind of has this gruff response at first. And then her aunt's like, hold on, like, you're not going to go upstairs and, you know, go retreat. I need to talk to you about this. And it's at that moment when her aunt is basically like, look, like, we're going to talk about this, you know, and this may be uncomfortable, but this is something that we need to talk about. And that's the moment when I really started to kind of pay attention to the dynamics at play and things like that, because I think that's such a powerful statement. And it's such a thing that we don't see happen often in a film, where one person wants to say something and the other person just kind of wants to maybe say something and then leave. And the other person is like, whoa, 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 hold on. Like, we need to have a conversation about what just happened here, you know? And I think that's such a great little moment in not just like what they say, but why they are saying it to each other.
To point out a specific moment in that scene too, what I think potentially even elevates that is, Bill, right after that moment where it seems like Sid is about to respond again and try to correct her aunt, even after, you know, after that great speech about saying that each person can have their own joy, and then Sid wanting to respond again, which, like, I think that was the moment that rang almost weirdly the most true to me, in the sense that, like, not only is it that, as you're saying, Bill, like, that she took a moment to say, like, no, wait, you're not going to retreat, but also that idea that, like, you know, just like, you know, like, sit with what I said. Don't try to, like, don't try to come back with a rebuttal.
Digest it.
Yeah. Like, that was the thing is that really, I think, brought home for me. And then specifically, I guess, are we in spoilers? I guess we are.
Yeah.
And
then,
And then
I don't know if you can spoil that much of this movie, but yeah.
The movie isn't really all about twists and turns. We find out some circumstances regarding Sid's family, but I think that like this is one of those movies that's kind of like an emotional journey, and that knowing all the beats of it won't detract from the actual like enjoyment of it.
But I guess what I wanted to speak specifically there, which I would say is, it's spoilers if this movie has any spoilers, is the fact that then we learn that something happened with Katie, and then for Katie to call to Miranda to cut right to them in the car. Like I think that there's an understanding here that speaks to like being in family, but also not only like Miranda's openness in talking about things, but also Bill, what you were talking about, which I think is really smart, is the reason this story works so well is because it's an aunt you haven't seen in a long time. Like, and that's how these conversations and how some things that maybe a mom or dad would maybe be uncomfortable with, you know, maybe knowing that your daughter is, you can hear your daughter having sex in another room is maybe not something you'd want to know. But it's that distance of an aunt that like gives some of these things the real push. I guess that's just what I wanted to say, is I think that whole sequence brought together kind of brings out how fleshed out that relationship is, which is something I feel like we don't get.
It's also funny because, you know, just talking about that openness, like we never really meet Sid's father in a meaningful way in this film, but like it almost feels like Miranda's probably more, I can't think of the right words for it. I would say prudish. That seems mean, but you know, she sort of is, and like not in a judgmental way, but yeah, she's like,
sure,
for herself at least, less permissive. And like, I think that it's just weird that we have in this movie, like the person who's kind of rigidly, has a rigid ideology is the younger person who seems more free. And the person who is the most bohemian in her beliefs is also the person who's like the most connected with like a religious organization and like has that more rigid morality. But her part of her own religious morality is like the allowance of other people to live their own lives,
mm-hmm.
and not having a problem with it. Like I feel like in another movie, it would be really awkward and like opposite. Like the novelist aunt would be like, I've had sex with everyone in this room multiple times, sometimes together. And it doesn't matter, Sid, like just have fun in this world. But it's not. And I think that is at once like clever, but also really true. And I think just on a filmmaking level and a writing level, good on this movie for not making that meeting of minds seem super insufferable.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have been to parties like that, and they are the goddamn worst.
I think one thing that's interesting is we don't ever see Miranda actually go to church, right? I think the only intonation here is that she does sometimes go to church, but maybe not always. Maybe it's not a frequent thing. And so it's interesting because we just don't have that awkward interaction. But I think it goes back to what a lot of us have said, and you know, conversations with my own girlfriend and things like that, where it's like I feel like going to a church instills a rigidity that doesn't allow you to move beyond for a lot of people, right? I think, not to decry mass religion and things like organized religion and things like that, but I think there is a certain free willness to being able to comfortably say, yes, I am religious, but maybe I don't go to church, right? Like maybe I read the Bible, or maybe I read the Quran, or maybe I read, you know, whatever it might be. But do I go and listen to someone tell me necessarily how to act and things like that? No, because, you know, I can manage my own life and I can manage in my own way, and I don't need that. And so I feel like this is reflective in some way of kind of Miranda's situation, where, you know, maybe she doesn't go to church that often, but she still considers herself religious ultimately.
Well, it's interesting, as a person who goes to church, how many mm-hmm. people who do that do suck in the way that you talk about people like that sucking. And yes. It's almost like sure. they view, like, well, I have my beliefs, and I'm going to go to church, and that's good. Like, that makes me a good person. I'm done. And it's also really strange as a Catholic, when we now have a very liberal pope who is, like, actually kind of speaking more to the Gospels than previous popes might have, not to get into a history of the papacy, but it's strange the kind of, like, shift that's happening in people's minds, where, you know, you're like, well, I'm a God-fearing person, and therefore X, Y, and Z. I almost said Z. Just gonna throw that out there. apparently my love of the Lost City of Zed has, like, turned my brain in some way. But so they say that, like, you know, I'm a God-fearing religious person, I go to church every week, and therefore all these things are inherently true. And then mm-hmm. you take someone who should be the arbiter of your religion, and the person who's
yes I was about to say
sure that it's, like, up on its modernity and is changing with the times so that living church and the ministry can go on. And then they say something and that person's like, well, he doesn't know what he's talking about. He's literally the Pope.
That's, yeah.
And it's just so strange yeah. that, like, that's a thing. And I've had to explain to my friends recently, like, well, how can the Pope say all these things? And it says it's so weird, because I'm like, well, as far as evolution is concerned, like, the Catholic Church has kind of been instrumental in, like, the building up of the sciences and people actually learning about evolution. And they've mm-hmm. talked about it for years. And then I think it was John Paul II, like, I think was the first pope who was like, yeah, aliens could exist. And people were like, sure. whoa, this person doesn't think the Earth is the center of the universe. And it's strange how, again, just how, like, any form of mental rigidity that you either, like, mm-hmm. feed through ignorance or through a strange limited dogmatic perspective can, like, harm people in that way.
Well, you know, my biggest I guess a hole poking in, you know, even Genesis and things like that is, you know, if God explained to you way back when how the Earth was formed and how evolution works and that the Earth revolves around the sun, people would just, like, their mind would melt. Like you can't explain it to them before they even know that the Earth is a sphere. Like you got to start at basics, right? And so yeah. people take a lot of that stuff and they're like, no, this is exactly how it happened. And it's like, really? Like,
well, there's that brilliant,
how old is this text?
There's, like, that brilliant scene how old in, what was it? Noah, where he says the story of Genesis, and Aronofsky actually, like, illustrates the way that, like, the actual creation of the universe syncs up to each of the days. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, because I once said to my dad when I was a young man, and we were talking about evolution and Genesis, and I was like, I don't understand. Like, why wouldn't God just, like, say it? And it's like, well, Brian, you know how, like, when you used to ask us why the sky was blue? And, like, mm-hmm. you know, if you were a 3-year-old and you're like, Dad, why is the sky blue? If I started talking about the waves of light and prismatic reflection and the way that the Earth's atmosphere is composed, like, what? Would you have listened to me? And I was like, no, probably not.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, well, there's yeah. water in the sky and water's blue. Oh, okay, great. Let's dumb it down just enough so that it's kind of true. But we can yeah, still build
it's
on it later.
Reddit. It's that Reddit category. Teach it to me like I'm 5 or whatever it is. Yeah, like it's like dumb it down so I can understand it, and then from there I can build on my knowledge of, you know, it's mathematics. It's anything. If I started telling you solve for x when 3x equals 15, you'd just be like, what the fuck are you talking about? I don't even know what 4 plus 4 equals. You know, it's like, you got to build that language. It doesn't work for me,
because when I went into algebra, I still had trouble with that.
I'm with you there, Brian. That's why I play with words.
Yeah.
And even then, I'm not very...
There's a fucking letter in this.
I think to make this even a little bit broader and to bring it back a little bit to... As you guys are talking about this, I'm thinking a little bit more about the problem with a lot of religious art. And I think it kind of gets into this problem again of like the letter of the law versus the spirit of the law, and the sense that a lot of religious art forgets that there's that spirituality, as we've kind of been talking about. It doesn't have to explicitly include praying. It doesn't have to explicitly include going to church. I think that a lot of I'm worried I'm getting too broad here, but I think a lot of conversation about religion and dogma gets so caught up in a lot of these, you know, logistical holes that, again, we lose the idea of, you know, why someone comes to religion in the first place. Like, I think that, to bring it back to Princess Cid, is why this is so successful for me as a religious film. In the same way, you know, weirdly the most recent film I can think that did this well, which I guess is kind of on the nose, is Silence, which I feel like was another film that seemed
step
to very
on
much
that face, baby.
seemed to very much meditate on the difference between the text and understanding the text. And when you are faced with something that directly contradicts the text. And that's what I think. I'm sure there are exceptions, but that has been my experience with a lot of religious art and a lot of the conversation, in a way that is almost a bigger barrier to me than like trying to get me into a physical space to talk about a higher power.
Well, my problem with a lot of religious art is that it's an oil painting of a baby that looks like a full-grown man. You said religious art, and I immediately started thinking of Renaissance paintings. And when you started talking about film, I was like, oh, right. And in Renaissance paintings, the Christ child actually was painted to look more like an adult man. I don't know why. It's very strange. Anyway, I think that what's interesting about this movie is that, like, this and, like, Terrence Malick films are, to me, like, the ideal of what, like, a modern religious-inclined piece of art should be. And I feel like this goes back again to why I like this movie so much, is that it's all about understanding people and coming to a conclusion about what's good for yourself, but respecting people who make a healthy decision about what is good for themselves as well. It's important to add the healthy part in, because if someone is screaming that they need to shoot heroin into their veins, that is someone who you don't have to respect their opinion, and maybe you should try to do something about.
Sure.
Because it's...
I don't remember that scene.
Yeah, no, not in this movie. You know, but... T2, Trainspotting, another top 10.
Sure.
So like, when someone is doing something that's healthy and not harming anyone else, like, your necessity to tell them that they're wrong drops. And I think that, again, that's something we've kind of lost sight of. And this movie is such an interesting examination of the way that these two people who... Because usually in a movie like this, like, one person just moves the other person all the way to the other side. And it's interesting how much, like, how minor the changes that these people make in each other are, but how impactful that they are. The aunt kind of opens up and allows herself to just be, like, a touch more free and, like, a little less, like, interior. And Cid, you know, comes to understand like empathy with other people and understanding what drives other people, and that will help her in her life to not be like bogged down in the same mindset that bogs down all my Facebook friends. And and it's just funny because like it's funny whenever people talk about like religious films to me. They're like, oh, you're Catholic, so do you like movies about religion, or do you like all those Christian films? And I think of something like
God's Not Dead.
Yeah, because I'm like, oh yeah, like I really love the Tree of, I really loved the Tree of Life. And they're like, well, what about like God's Not Dead? I'm like, well, that's fucking trash. I don't need that in my life. And I had a conversation with a friend who is not Catholic but is going to be marrying a Catholic, and she asked me, like, do you think Balak is like a closet Catholic? And I'm like, I don't know if he's actually Catholic, but it's kind of funny how many of like the principles that he seems to stand on align with that. It's like the Platonic ideal of what a person who comes to it on their own would kind of think of. And what's good about that, and what I think is good about that kind of storytelling, is that it gives you kind of a moral framework or a theologically academic framework through which to start viewing the world in a way that is constructive rather than being at the best really rigid and inflexible, and at worst like honestly bad for you. The opposite of this would be something like War Room from 2015. Does anyone hear about this film?
I've heard about it. I definitely didn't see it, though.
So, I haven't seen this movie, but from what I had been led to believe by the reviews I read of it and looking at it now on IMDb, it's about a woman and a man who are married, and their marriage is like terrible and falling apart. And part of that is because the husband is like abusive. And the moral of the film is to like pray real hard and like God will help to fix your marriage, because the last thing that God wants is for you to get divorced. And that is a real thing in the kinds of like Protestant evangelical sects that make these movies like courageous and fireproof. And that is like the worst, most destructive thing that you could possibly do. I know people whose parents stayed together in like terrible relationships because it's like, well, I've made a promise before God and I can't leave my husband. I have to honor him. And like, you know, if we just try harder, God will deliver us from this. It's like, no, you're harming your children. Everything is going poorly. What are you doing? You need to get out of there. And it's weird to think that like people who profess to believe in the same thing can create two wholly different works and like come to two wholly different concepts. It's just very strange. It's a very strange world to live in. And I think that a movie like Princess Cid shows like the best in all possible genres just through its sheer openness and empathy and like careful understanding of its characters and the beliefs that they hold. Like, you never in this movie have a moment where you're questioning what the motivations of someone are, because they're written and acted to a point that you feel as though you understand enough to understand all the choices that they're going to make. And on that level, talking about the acting, I want to, you know, we obviously all disagreed about a lot of things in Call Me By Your Name, one of which was the chemistry between T. Chalamet and Armie Hammer.
Timothy
Chalamet and Armie Hammer. I think that, like, Jesse Pinnock and Malik White, who play Sid and Katie, like, that is the thing where, like, they looked at each other and I was just like, oh, shit, like, immediately. Like, there was so much just in the way that, like, they held each other, not that held each other, where they, their body language and their eyes and everything was just immediately like, oh, okay, I've been in a situation like this. I understand exactly how this is. Like, they could have never seen each other again throughout the entire movie or even spoken about each other, And I would have said, oh, in that moment, they were like the most beautiful people to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, I think, it's a tough line to walk. But in this movie, there is all of like the spark and incendiary chemistry that's like undeniable that I just did not see anywhere in Call Me By Your Name.
I think it's, I think that, I don't know. There's something interesting, and I think it's weird because I'd probably I'm not trying to open Pandora's box here. I think there is something more healthy about this relationship without getting into any of the context. I think there's something about understanding yourself and knowing yourself in Princess Sid between Katie and Sid, in their relationship and in the kind of wholesomeness that it has from the beginning. And I think that Call Me By Your Name is an odder experience because it's based in this sexual energy that is much more competitive. It's much more, it's explosive, but more in a taboo way. Like it's not about a like open-hearted, like I see immediately these people have a connection. And I see why some people like don't vibe with that even beyond other issues. Like I understand that's like for many people that you can't extricate those other issues. But I do think at the same time, I think there is a little bit different dynamic.
Well, it's kind of weird because we're obviously dancing around my issues with Call Me By Your Name,
sure.
But I can run a mental experiment and say like, let's say that they were both in their 20s, which I think that the actors both are.
Are we talking about?
Yeah, Call Me By Your Name. There's so much more, like, earnest, like, yearning and affection, and like a kind of sense of finding like a shared spirit with someone in Princess Sid, and in Call Me By Your Name, like. When they finally like decide to like, what's the
kiss for
right
the first
word?
Time?
Yeah, like when they finally start to like make out in the field and then have sex in the room, it still felt like teasing or like I don't want to say mean spirited, but like I very rarely ever felt like any warmth or affection between them. Which is like not something you need in order to have sex with someone, obviously, but it just is. It's strange how much more like just these two like hanging out and talking on a rooftop and then pretending to dance for a film crew that was doing a thing in the background. It had so much more of that like pent up passion and like earnest emotional like need and necessity than anything that I really saw in Call Me By Your Name.
I think that's fair. And like full disclosure, I have never really totally vibed with the idea that Call Me By Your Name is primarily a love story. Like I think it's way more about what a first love does to someone's like state of being.
But I think not to get into Call Me By Your Name. I swear to God, I'm not trying to do that. But like,
no, sure, sure.
It's just weird that because like in that case, I think I would still want Chalamet's character to like act like Sid or something. Like they felt very ironic in their affections for each other.
That is also fair.
Yeah, in a way that like I think I even said during the episode, it seemed weird to me. And like so I can understand like it's not about true love, it's about just how love can like fuck you up. But the expression of love from both sides never felt like it was moving towards that.
I guess I could speak to at least some of my experiences being like that. So maybe I, a little bit, my brain just kind of, you know, it just went right over it without actually.
You had a lot of like ironic love affairs, like where you're like.
I'm not trying to get graphic in any way. I'm saying that some of my experiences with the same sex are like they were couched in this certain like dance back and forth and like this weird irony is, I guess, almost the right word. I worry about irony because you can also call like, you know, James Franco's obsession with, you know, homo, no homo, like affectation, ironic. Yeah. And I don't think that's what this is. I think there's something. Yeah, it's almost more something like dance-like, like more darting around each other. I'm sorry. I feel like I'm Bill. I mean, do you have any thoughts about these relationships? Did you also see them as relatively different?
Well, I think there's something interesting about just a gay romance portrayed on screen, period, because I think there's something dangerous, even in our modern world, there's something dangerous about kind of figuring out whether you make eyes at someone and whether that means that you just enjoy their company or you are sending out signals that maybe is sexual. Because I think in both of these situations, neither of them have navigated neither Sid nor Timothy nor maybe even Armie Hammer's character have really navigated being gay and being around. Timothy, the only real person or people that we see in his life that are openly gay are people that he calls Sharon. And in kind of a dismissive quality, but you know, they are played up in a way that you would expect someone to actually kind of like scoff at, right? Like they
there's
are
a flamboyance.
They're
that's
very
still
flamboyant.
The best line of that movie too. Do you call them that because they're gay or because they're ridiculous?
Yeah,
that's a pretty good line.
and it's one of those things where if you are just in modern society and a man and a woman connect and they look at each other in a certain way, you know there's an attraction. And it's not mystified in like, oh, no, I just like enjoy your company. If you start making eyes at someone like that, it's usually kind of explicitly like, hey, like I'm really into you. And I think with same-sex kind of couples and you know the start of a relationship like that, you know, look, I've not ventured into that area of life, but I would certainly expect that there's some confusion about do you just enjoy my company or is there something more here that we can kind of explore and that we can kind of figure out? And I think there's always that kind of danger of miscommunication in that way. And so I think both of these films do a good job of kind of setting that up. But I think explicitly in Princess Sid, it happens so fast and neither of them are against it. Neither of them are pushing back against it that it happens so fast that you just kind of go with the flow in a lot of ways in this film. And so I think there's something more, I wouldn't say it's necessarily wholesome, but I think there's just something more fluid.
Organic, maybe?
Yeah. Organic about their relationship and the way it starts in it. It starts as just like if you didn't realize or if you didn't acknowledge that one was a female and one was that they were both female, right? Like if this happened in most films, the Call Me By Your Name film would have been just stupid if it was a male and a female, because you would just been like, why haven't y'all hooked up yet? You know, and and in
then
this,
he would have had to make it explicitly about the age, because like other than that, there's no drama.
Sure,
it's just sure. Like, oh sure. Man, these two poor, really hot people hanging out in Italy.
Yeah, and they just refuse to hook up with each other. It's like, what,
there's a lot of movies about that. Let's be honest.
They're hooking up with other people except themselves, right? You know, it's just like, what are y'all doing?
It's basically like a Bret Easton Ellis novel, but without the existential dread. It's nothing but hot people hooking up with people that they don't like.
Yeah, so this film, it never buries itself in that, and so you're never questioning why they aren't, because as soon as you kind of question that, they pretty much are. You know, and it's just like, okay, they're skipping steps. They're moving forward pretty rapidly with this, and nothing about it feels predatory. Nothing about it feels weird or awkward. It just feels like it's natural, because we don't know Sid's background really. We know that she's got somewhat of a boyfriend or whatever, but it's like, yeah, she's not really tethered to anybody, and we know
kind of into that other person's son who's Kate. There.
Yeah, Ridley, but I mean, yeah. we don't even see that at first, but it's all just kind of so fluid, you know. And so it's interesting, because this is another example of a bisexual, like, you know, main character. So
definitely doesn't happen very often. I think one other Bill, as you're talking about it, I think you're really right that there's something a little bit different even about the first interaction with Sid and Katie. I think, you know, you even think about, you know, after she's like, you want to go for a walk, and obviously they end up on the roof shortly after that, where she is misgendered, and it becomes like, I feel like from the beginning there is a familiarity and understanding that, you know, that Katie has an androgynous appearance. You know, she is someone who would be misgendered, and I think there is a certain queerness that is projected in this film that isn't in something like Call Me By Your Name. And I think specifically Call Me By Your Name, like, I, at least for me, what I found kind of consistently entertaining was the weird way that, like, their very masculine, like, peacocking is ambiguous about whether they're into each other, whether they're just being very dudely. Like, we didn't really get it. There are certainly things that I don't like about Call Me By Your Name, but it is definitely, I think that dynamic when it comes to two men, especially when you think, you know, in a community where you're not, as Bill was saying, you don't know whether, you know, you're just getting close to someone or whether it's something else. And when you, like, even when you consider that, like, I think the other interesting thing to think about Princess Sid is it takes place in Chicago. It takes place in a place where there are people from many different backgrounds and has many different views, which comes into the film. And I think especially this movie works in, I think I talked about this a little bit on the top 10. This movie works in such interesting conversation with Stephen Cohen's other films, which I think do all take place in the South. I think one of them is in South Carolina, and I'm forgetting the other thing, but those are very much about, like, people misunderstanding signals, people doing something and having major blowback happen. Like, I think that there is something very, I said special, that doesn't fucking mean anything. There's something resonant about the film taking place in Chicago and taking place where it does, even beyond knowing what type of person Miranda is.
One of the things that I found interesting about this film is that it's the first, like, it's one of the, it's obviously not the first, but in, like, in all of my years of watching a movie, I feel like this is one of the best at, like, having a gay romance that just functions as a romance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, every movie that comes out that gets, like, real heavy critical praise, it always treats the concept of a homosexual relationship as, like, fraught with inherent tension in a way that a heterosexual relationship isn't, which has always, like, come off as, like, a little... It's like those people who are like, oh, like, where are you from? And then a person will say, like, oh, my family's Japanese. And then they'll say, oh, that's so exotic. And it's like, I understand what you're trying to do, but do you not see how that is almost worse than just acting with disinterest? Like,
I think part of that, and I understand where you're coming from, because a lot of these films do treat it like that. And I definitely understand. I think part of it is, as we grow older, I think there's going to be less and less of that.
I hope
so. Because you have to realize that a lot of these people, these filmmakers that are making those kinds of films, did not grow up in an age of Facebook or text messaging and things like that, where you can have coded language or you can have explicit language and it doesn't have to blow up in your face. I remember recently listening to a podcast and they were talking about how, you know, if you were gay, you had to use coded language in so many ways, and that they were looking at kind of like the Aziz Ansari thing where you know, people weren't explicitly upfront about what they were saying or whatever you may want to interpret from that situation. And they were like, you know, nowadays, when you're gay, you have the opportunity to basically lay out everything that you want to do, that you're willing to do. And then if it doesn't go the way that you want or plan, you're pretty damn open to just be like, nope, fuck it. I'm leaving. I'm gone. I'm out of here.
That's one of the things I found in that vein, the movie Beginners.
Yes.
Is really interesting. Oh my God, Bill. It's so good.
I know.
It's my cry movie. It's whenever I need to cry, I put on Beginners. And it happens pretty quickly and then pretty constantly. But Christopher Plummer in that movie is a man who came up during a time where it was, like, straight up illegal to be gay.
Mm-hmm.
And
Ewan
McGregor. Yeah, that's the one.
Yes.
I almost said Ian McEwan, the celebrated British novelist. That is not true. Ian McEwan. No, damn it. I did it. It's Ewan McGregor. Ewan McGregor is talking about that. And then when his mother dies, his father's like, all right, well,
I apologize about the police in the background, guys.
Oh, man.
Oh, Chicago. Michael,
they're coming for Mike.
There's a warrant out on me, just to feel.
for what?
I don't know. I don't have anything fun to say. All right, I continue the podcast.
All right. So Ewan McGregor is talking about, like, you know, his dad, you know, back in the day, he couldn't, like, you know, this is where men used to meet for sex, and it was like a men's room.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you could lose everything if the vice squad caught you. And now his dad, now that his wife has died, is like, well, it's time for me to, like, live my life as an out gay man. And I think that is a really interesting way to have that same conversation without trying to mine that tragedy for dramatic interest, like showing a person who can finally cut loose, like the scene where he comes home. Well, you wouldn't know this, Bill, but he comes home and says, like, you know, Oliver, I went out to a gay bar, like, they were playing this wonderful music, and then he kind of does, like, a beat with his mouth, and his son's like, that's called house music, Dad. And he's like, oh, okay, I'm gonna write that down, house music. And it's just like, I think that there's something a lot more interesting and a lot more constructive with showing, like, the joy that comes after than with showing how hard it used to be. And I look forward to younger filmmakers kind of being able to explore that more and be able to utilize that kind of joy in the way that this film does. I mean,
well, Sid
and Katie. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Michael.
I'm sorry. I just want to respond to that a little. I was talking to a friend about this recently, and to put the critical community a little bit on trial here. I think there's something really accurate in what you were saying about exoticize in a way, Brian, because there is something very frustrating that the bigger films are all about that external drama. Like, yeah. To be clear, I like a lot of those bigger. I turned around on Moonlight. I like Carol. Like a lot of the big ones that, you know, have risen above the pack as far as awards consideration and things like that. Like, I think the problem with, you know, exoticizing, or excuse me, of the things that do arise are so, they are for, I'm going to generalize here to make my point, but okay. For straight people and for people who aren't familiar with the lifestyle, there is a certain like it's certain fantasy aspect to certain one of these films, especially where LGBT or queer people have to go through some tragedy, have to be punished for things. I mean, you look even like decades back, you think of something like speaking specifically about films related to, you know, trans people, you think about Boys Don't Cry, which, you know, is a movie I like a lot, but is very much about tragedy. Like that is the primary thing. And even this year's foreign language Oscar film, A Fantastic Woman, is very much about a trans woman being misunderstood and kind of punished by the world for living her own existence. And I think there is – I think there's something easier for people who aren't a part of this community to try to understand and to sympathize when there is something that happens to those people. But then it is frustrating, Brian, as you're saying, that something like Princess Cid or, you know, equivalent films about the gay experience aren't getting talked about. And I think that straight people and, you know, people across the spectrum are admittedly getting different things from something like Moonlight and from something like, you know, BPM, which is about the AIDS crisis. And it was a film I loved, but it's very much like an exhausting film to watch people go through this constant pain. And I'm not saying those films don't exist, but I think that goes back to an inability to understand some people without dramatizing their life.
Well, yeah, because it's a weird thing that I've been struggling with recently, because it's like, well, we want audiences to sympathize with the, like, whomever we're choosing, like be it a minority of any kind. We need to make this person sympathetic. So what if we just really fucked him up? Like, what if we made them Jesus in The Passion of the Christ and just, like, really put them through a ringer? And it's like, that seems cruel, and it also seems very patronizing to the members of the audience who would feel that empathy for someone just because of their humanity. And I know that, like...
But the creators don't have that in mind. Like, yeah. I definitely don't think Barry Jenkins, you know, for instance, made... I think that he experiences that pain very differently than a lot of people who I don't want to assume people are ignorant. I do think that there is a different experience, and there's especially a problem within a critical and general community in how to react to LGBT films.
Yeah. And I think that that's kind of what gets at me. It's like if those were a part of the stories we were being told and were being lauded by critics, I really probably wouldn't have a problem with it, but like, that's kind of it. Like if your character isn't going through some shit or being beaten for who they are, you know, we don't really want to hear about you. And it just seems like a massive step backwards. And, it's something that I brought up in the Call Me By Your Name podcast, but like I listened to this, podcast, Black Men Can't Jump in Hollywood. And one of the guys on there just hates a slave narrative. Like, doesn't want to deal with it because, like, why do we need more of that? And why can't we just have a person who's living a life, any kind of normal modern life? You know, why does it always have to be a victim narrative? Because, like, that is the way that we start to look at people, is just like through the prism of how we see them portrayed in culture, especially if we don't have many of them in our lives in total. You know, the stories told are the ones that we assume, you know, outside of the superheroes and stuff, but are the ones that we assume, like, affect the greatest amount of people.
Sure.
There's a universality to storytelling. I'm sorry, go ahead, Bill.
That's the issue with Hollywood in general, and where us as Americans, you know, consume most of our cinema is from old white dudes, like old straight white dudes, you know, and that's gonna have a lot of issues. Thankfully, Cohn is a white male. I'm not sure about his sexuality, but. You know, it is what it is. And so he's obviously bucking the trend in a lot of ways, where he's made a film that has a bi character at the heart of it, that also has a character that is directly tags herself as religious, but isn't outspokenly like, oh, you know, you're going to hell for doing these things and XYZ, right?
That really, like, never comes up, which is like, great, because I was so worried about that.
So I think I'm not sure where that's coming from Stephen Cohn. Maybe it's his surroundings. Maybe he's just such a young modern filmmaker that he's absorbed a lot of that culture and, you know, not pushed back against it. Maybe he's got a lot of really strong females in his life. I'm not sure where that kind of, you know, why other fucking people that are white males can't do it as well as he is doing it. But I don't know. You know, it's a question for introspection that I think a lot of people kind of need to have. And I think there's also maybe he's seeking out that challenge of writing well-rounded characters that aren't necessarily look and act and say the same things as he does, you know?
Yeah. I mean, at the very core, he is a white man who has made a movie that is about two women, and that, you know, and he wrote it and he directed it and, like, he put them at the center of it. And that is something that not a lot of white men do. We didn't even bring up the fact that, like, the only other kind of sort of romance in this is also between, like, a white woman and a black man, which is still something
that
can get you in trouble in places. And I think what to me is the most interesting about this film, and I'm gonna say we should probably wrap it up because we've been talking for an hour and 22 minutes, and this is an hour and 39 minute long movie, and we try not to talk about the movies longer than they exist. And one of the things that really strikes me about this movie is that it's a movie with a religious character that is not a religious movie. It's a movie with a bisexual character at the center of it, but it's not like an LGBTQ skewing movie. It's a story. It's a story about two people, and those people have very different lives, but it's not a movie that clings to the identity of its characters to give itself an identity. And I think that is the direction that, like, cinema can go in to be the type of inclusive that we're all hoping for, but that also allows for a movie to exist outside of seemingly the group it was created for, which is, like, an important thing, because you can make a movie that has diversity of race or ethnicity or religion or sexuality, but if you make it explicitly to prop up the beliefs of the group that you are, like, targeting it to, then the people who need to see that movie will never see it. Whereas a movie like this has such, like, an openness of humanity that I think that it plays to all spheres.
I don't get the sense in this film that certain characters are picked to say pieces of dialogue because of who they are. Like, even speaking of, you know, I do kind of want to mention Anthony, that
Anthony James,
Anthony James,
Vincent Meredith.
Yeah, he's really excellent, and that's I think that's as much that's as much as his acting as the writing, which I think gets into a really interesting thing because it's clear from the filmmaking that Miranda and Anthony have a long history. Mm-hmm. And, you know, mm-hmm. Sid kind of pokes at it being like, you know, why aren't you guys seeing each other? And like
and even the family kind of his family kind of pokes at it a little bit, you know.
Yeah.
Because I think it's the grandma or the mother at one point is just like, why haven't y'all hooked up yet? Like, and both of them are just kind of like look at each other bashfully, and it's just like, yeah, y'all are fucking grown adults. Like, what are y'all doing? You know?
But it's kind of cute because it's like, maybe they don't need to, or maybe they will later.
Yeah.
Like, maybe they're moving at their own pace. And it's just
it points to that joy conversation.
Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's, again, like one of the things that I like about this movie is that, like, it allows for the, like, the breadth of time that, like, at the end of the movie, like, she's not with him. And maybe they will be together, but maybe they won't be. But, like, also, they're happy how they are. Like, they're getting everything that they need from one another right now without having to do the thing that everyone else assumes that they need to do to be, like, truly exactly. happy.
Sure.
Yeah.
And similarly, and they Sid and Katie aren't in, like, super committed relationship, but it's clear that that was, you know, a summer period that obviously had effect on her as a young woman. Like, yeah, this is a good movie.
It's a damn good movie. I hope we've gotten that across, how much we like this movie. And I really do, like, it's one of those things where every once in a while I think, like, man, when Malick and Scorsese die, I might as well just kill myself. Because, like, what else am I, like, living for? But then, like, I see a movie like this, or, you know, hopefully Rian Johnson starts making some original movies again. And I think, you know, there are, like, on the young side filmmakers who are actually doing stuff that I find to be interesting and that, like, could be the next thing that I really get into. And so it's just good to find a movie like this that kind of, like, reinstills in me some hope for the future of cinema. Because that wavers every now and then.
Isn't Alex Ross Perry pretty young?
Oh yeah. Can't wait. He's gonna live forever. Speaking of which, we may be talking about Golden Exits when it comes out. It just depends on how much liquor I have in my house.
And how dead your computer is at that moment.
Yeah, I'm just gonna like throw it against the wall and be like, sorry guys.
I did not support this decision.
It's become a runner.
I do want to go ahead.
I was going to say, part of me feels like, just as a completionist, like we have to do it, right? Like we have to do Golden Exits.
I'm not into that.
If there is a serialized aspect to this podcast, it is my hatred of Alex Ross Perry films.
I do want to mention that this film right now is on Amazon in HD for 99¢. So if you've gotten to this point in the podcast and you're like, Jesus, where can I find this fucking thing? There you go. You can find it. It's on Amazon for 99¢.
Something we should have probably put at the top of it. We'll tweet it out when we tweet out this episode.
Yes.
What was I going to say? I'm just looking forward to, in conclusion, I'm looking forward to seeing every one of these actors in something else. I'm looking forward to Stephen Cohen's next film. And I think that's it. I think that's all I got.
She does look a little bit like Olivia Wilde.
Yeah, someone on my Facebook mentioned that she looked like Olivia Wilde, and she does look a little like Olivia Wilde. Jesse Pinnock.
Yes.
All right. So next week, Golden Exits, maybe.
Or Jumanji, apparently.
Or Jumanji.
Or Paddington 2.
Or Paddington 2. There's some things out there.
We've got fucking options, man.
Yeah, we're also still got to talk about Paris, Texas. Everyone has now seen that movie, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And then
there'll be some interesting, like, almost companion conversations in Paris, Texas with this a little bit.
I think so.
I was going to say this, maybe Call Me By Your Name, Paris, Texas gets around. And then the weekend after that, we will be doing Black Panther.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then...
Wakanda Forever!
Yes.
Trying to figure out a guest. I have some possibilities I need to reach out to. Sweet. But if anybody has any suggestions, please let us know.
Yeah. And then after that, we'll be talking about, I believe, Annihilation.
Yes.
So we got
even
some,
though nobody wants to see it. Nobody wants us to see it, apparently.
Is that a thing?
No, I got a screening invite. I got a screening invite. But it is that I think no, it is at 7:30. So
I thought you meant like our fans didn't want us to see it.
No, it's not being shown in theaters around the world, yeah, except for the United States.
Yeah.
And then Paramount was uncomfortable with the final cut because the test screening didn't go well.
Yeah,
good old fucking Texas. People in Montana have a lot of effect on shit.
Damn, poor Montana.
Bill from Texas, you know, just going to town on Montana. Just like the Eagles are gonna go to the town on the Patriots. I really got to get this like podcast out before the Super Bowl begins, or else that will not be a funny joke.
Because the Eagles are definitely going to get ripped to shreds.
I don't know. The Patriots, like, they're obviously like the Yankees of football, but I feel like every now and then they allow themselves to become a little bit hubristic, and that could be their downfall.
The interesting thing about that dynamic is people assume that they are the Yankees of football, but they do not spend the money on their players the Yankees do.
No, they don't.
The Yankees are very much like... Yes, the Yankees are just like, oh, who's that modern player that's really good? $40 million a year? Yeah, we'll take him.
I meant Yankees like, in terms of like they're consistently perform very well and everyone hates them.
Sure.
Yeah,
I agree.
I'm not talking
that.
About
yeah.
the way that they run their club.
Yes.
Yes. And that's it. Thank you for joining us. Remember to give to our Patreon, patreon.com/thefilmstageshow. $1
yeah,
episode.
If you want to spend $2, you can watch this movie and get access to our Slack channel. Oh, how about that?
So patreon.com/thefilmstageshow. Give us your money. Go to movie.com/filmstage. And while you've given us your money, you can get something from us for free. 30 days of movie for your streaming delight. Go to movie.com. They've got their Sundance Selects going on right now, so you can see great movies like Room 237, Ain't Them Body Saints, and many others. You can download them to watch on the go, or you can watch them on your smart TV or any other device you have. Go to mubi.com/filmstage for your free 30-day trial. All right. That is it for today. And, we will talk to you at some point during the middle of the week with Paris, Texas, and next week we will be talking about insert here. I don't know. Golden exits would be hilarious, but like, I really don't know if I'm prepared for that. Anyway, let's tell the five people where we can be found between now and the next time. Bill Graham.
You can find me sitting on the couch watching the Super Bowl at Cable BFG. You can also find me on the Slack channel. Having a lot of fun there still. Yep.
Yeah. All right. Michael Snydell.
You can find me on Twitter at Snydell, probably tweeting about something other than the Super Bowl. But I hope everybody who watches the Super Bowl enjoys it.
And you can find me tweeting my live reaction to every single Super Bowl commercial at Brian J. Rowan on Twitter. I'm not going to do that. That sounds exhausting. It sounds like the worst possible.
Nope.
That sounds like the type of thing I would do right before killing myself.
You already promised.
yeah, I guess I kind of got it. Anyway, so that's at Brian J. Rowan on Twitter. You can find this show at Film Stage Show. And you can find my personal site, dearfilm.net, as well as, I don't know, that's about it. I really got nothing else to say. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us, and tune in next week.